Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
An Erio's original.
There's a version, a demo version, that I actually think is better than the original.
Wow.
The lyrics are almost totally different. Instead of like him, it was sung to her.
Outspoken women on stage being funny, I feel like it is like such an encouraging, positive sign of democratic action.
It's taking over my dreams, waking me out of my sleep. I think I'm coming apart.
Welcome to The Margaret Show, where we talk to people you know and people you should know. Today, I am talking with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Amy Mann.
Yeah, I'm coming out of the dark. Oh.
And thanks for coming over.
Oh, you're welcome.
We have some bandmates in common. I do some music with Grant.
Oh, Grant is the best.
He is amazing.
He's the best.
He's amazing. And I've recorded over at Ryan's place in like a...
Oh, Ryan is the best
also. He's amazing.
You have two of the best.
Yeah.
An accordion in the room. Do you play accordion?
I'm trying. It's hard. I don't understand it either.
I have never tried, but I'm just starting a project that will require accordion.
Ooh.
And I'm like, how do I write? Maybe I just don't write for it. Maybe I just like get a great guy to play it later.
Well, I think maybe it's, I think like, it's, I find that it's a cross between a harmonium and a piano, and it's just the bellows. And if you can kind of noodle around with it, you could probably get something very pleasing.
Yeah.
But it's very strange.
There's too many things to do all at once.
It's the buttons that confound me.
I don't understand the buttons.
The buttons, I'm like, I don't know, but I wish that I was more adept at it because it's a cool looking instrument.
It's very cool.
And it sounds beautiful.
Yeah, I feel like it can do a lot, but, you know, it's just a lot to master.
And it's heavy.
It's heavy, right?
It hurts my back, but it's also, like, I think it's amusing because you can actually sort of stay in the game, like, of, like, talk. Like, if you're singing, you can sort of stay upright. As the guitar, I'm always looking down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even piano, you're always, like, facing something else. But with accordion, you're, like, with your audience.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. You can stay forward.
So, but I look forward to hearing your voice with the accordion.
It's for a musical idea that I'm working on with some friends, and so I may not be the one singing it, but
that's really cool.
But also maybe I would record some of those songs. Who knows?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I think that, so we have some, bandmates in common. Paul Bryan also.
Fabulous person.
Great, 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 great players all. And, but I love playing with Grant because there's a kind of assurance that he, brings to the band stage.
Yeah.
That's kind of a comfort.
Yeah, he's incredibly talented, great voice, great songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
He's everything. I thought he lived in Nashville.
I thought that he moved to Nashville. Where is he now?
I thought he was now in Nashville.
He is, yes.
Okay.
So now he's in Nashville, but he's touring a lot. And they moved there when with the night baby, Violet, because she was the baby. Well, she would stay up all night, so she was, we called her the baby of the night.
Oh, my God.
So he was out there with Denise and the baby of the night, Violet. And then he's on the road a lot. And
hopefully he's sleeping at a normal hour.
I think now. But, they were like, oh, Amy only wants to do one take of that song. Like, you... Do you always only do one take?
That's hilarious that for to have that reputation. Probably, I've occasionally just done one take. I don't like to rehearse something. I don't like to play it or do so many takes that I get like that it gets lost to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm rarely a one take singer, but it's happened on occasion.
Yeah,
I feel like it's kind of a miracle. Like I'm. It's funny that I would be known as the one take person.
Well, it's kind of like it makes me feel better because I don't want to do any more takes than one. And I'm not a one take singer, and I'm not a one take anything. But for some reason, I think I should be.
Yeah.
Like I think it's because I've done really long sessions with Desmond Child, and with him, you'll do 200 takes.
Wow.
It's too many takes.
There, I need to know what that story is, how that happened.
Well, I don't.
That is too many takes. It ruins. You can't get inside the music anymore. It ruins it.
But it's also like, I'm not that kind of a singer.
Yeah.
You know, like they are talking like Laura Nero or even something like Chaka Khan. I don't have that kind of a dynamic voice. So like for me, it's like, let's just like make kind of sound on key.
Yeah.
That's all I care about.
Yeah.
But with him, I did a song that was actually like a cast off of a Britney song in 2008 called Millennium Woman. And it was by Andreas was the writer. So it was like one of those Max Martin guys.
Got it.
So
yeah.
And then so we did it at Record Plant. So it was like a huge session.
That's a big session.
And I didn't have to pay for anything, thank God. But it was great. And Desmond was the producer and so we're in there, but we were in there for so long, and I really wanted to cry because it was so many takes.
Yeah, that would depress me. That's too much.
It's too many takes, and it's like, well,
I would say five takes is where it's like, all right, I'm done.
Yeah.
Where that's like the limit of still enjoying the song and also just not like losing what the vibe of the song is.
Right. But it's like that, you know, there's so much intimacy in your songs. And, you know, because of one of your songs, I increased my age on my dating profile. So now I went up because of Mr. Harris. I have gone up to 71 on, no, 73 on my, no, 71. Oh 71 God. Is the limit on my dating profile because I keep thinking about Mr. Harris living with a sister in a furnished flat.
Right. So maybe you'll get an old guy. You'll get like a solid 15 and then you move on to the next one.
I love that. I love that song because I can see him in my mind's eye. And then I kind of think Amateur is about him after he broke up.
Oh, that's funny. No, it isn't. But I actually saw, I was in Brookline in Boston when I lived in Boston. And I was walking around the neighborhood and I actually saw like an old guy like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of dressed in his Sunday best, raking his little yard. Beautiful. And it was just so awesome. So that's who I based it on.
It makes me cry because it's like such a loving song that's so full of hope. And it's like this thing of like, when you're... searching for those kinds of things of like when you're writing a perfect love song, like it doesn't necessarily have to speak to your own experience, but it is like it's so real, it feels like it happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's nice, thank you.
Which I love, but then I was like, oh, and the relationship was terrible, and then she wrote Amateur.
No, Amateur is written about probably a compendium of people.
Well, Amateur to me is like first of all, it's a waltz,
yeah,
which is so exciting in pop music.
I love a waltz.
I love it.
I could literally just write nothing but waltzes if I was allowed to.
It feels so good. And it also feels like very Victorian, too. Mm-hmm. There's something about it that I want to like, I feel like that there should be a player piano that I can scroll.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That it'll play on.
That drum loop is on a machine called the Optagon, which was like, you know, kind of like a mellotron, which would play loops of things, but it would play, you know, actual sort of pieces of bands playing. So that little brump-da-dump, that, and you can hear, you know, the age in it. You can hear like it sounds like it's from an old record.
It does, but it doesn't have like that very self-conscious crackle. Like, you know, when you're watching like a reality TV show and there'll be like a needle skip?
Yeah. Yeah, it does not have a fake crackle. Yeah.
You know, the crackle is there, but it's so real and recessed in the background, mm-hmm. that it almost just exists in your mind's eye as like the flicker of a kinescope.
Yeah.
There's so much depth in your production, and I was going back and watching Magnolia, and for me it's really like a great tradition of like Hal Ashby doing like the Cat Stevens, all of Harold
and
Maude,
his
Cat Stevens songs, or even is it Mike Nichols that did The Graduate that did all of the Simon and Garfunkel?
Yeah.
Was that the approach that P.T. Anderson had with that?
I think so. He never really articulated that to me, but I sort of feel like that was the idea, that he liked that, you know, one artist voice through a whole movie.
And it's very perfect for that film because it's all of these different stories.
Yeah.
And yet having your voice as a character, almost like you're singing throughout it, is a character in the movie.
That's very interesting. It never occurred to me, but that I think that's a really good point. That that's like, yeah, to have one singer throughout the whole thing is acts as kind of an anchor to tie the
stories
together.
It's like a voiceover,
right?
A narrator that, which I think exists. There is a narrator in Magnolia, but he only appears a couple of times.
Yeah,
like it's when Patton's falling off the tree.
Yeah,
and then when the frogs.
Right, right, right.
So I think that's the only times where you hear it, but then your voice throughout it. And then I really am very comforted whenever I hear you do Harry Nilsson.
Well, I mean, it's a great song, and you know, you kind of can't go wrong.
Do you cover any other Harry Nilsson?
I don't think so, but I do love his songs.
I do love his songs.
But he's such a great singer. Like, it's hard to want to replace his voice with your own.
But there's something about when you sing songs from men that it really resonates with me. You know, in that movie, the soundtrack in particular with like One or Logical song.
That I didn't sing that, but that's in there.
Yeah. But those kinds of, you know, like, especially with One, that's that kind of thing of like, it really fits your voice. Like, if there's a comfort there.
Right. Yeah.
In it. And I feel like I've heard you sing Gilbert O'Sullivan.
I think I've done a cover of
Naturally.
Probably Alone Again Naturally. Like, not, I don't think I recorded it, but I know I've sung it because it's one of my favorite songs.
It's like a deep, it's a deep comfort and warmth. But yeah, in that movie, Save Me is sort of like the thing of like, I think I'm also like, every time Julianne Moore's in a movie, I'm her.
Yeah.
So whether Boogie Nights, I'm definitely her in Magnolia in the pharmacy. And I'm definitely definitely her yelling at her husband without pants on in Shortcuts. I'm definitely her there. But
so much pantsless yelling.
I love it. It's so good. But yeah, Save Me is such a beautiful song. Did you write that specifically for the movie, or was it written and then you
kind of at the same time as Paul and I were working sort of simultaneously. So it was like the movie wasn't completely finished, but the script was, you know.
Yeah. But it's beautiful. And then did you play a song, or did you get nominated for an Academy Award?
Yep.
And for
Save Me.
For Save Me. Mm-hmm. And then I remember you had a white suit, right? Or who played with you and had a white suit?
That's so funny, because Elliot Smith had a white suit the year before.
I mixed metaphor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I remember watching you on there. Who did you play with?
And that was the year that they decided that each song would only get 30 seconds, so they would mash them all together and do a medley. So I like played for 30 seconds, and then like Randy Newman, like, you know, we'd throw over to, you know, Randy Newman or the South Park guys. Like, and it was like so unfair. 30
that
seconds
is unfair
per song. Come on.
To be nominated. I mean, then, you know, because that is my favorite part of the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, now they really get, like, each one has its own showpiece. And I know we had to do a medley with each other. We were all looking side-eyed at each other.
That's
like,
not cool.
I gotta share the stage. Yeah, this is my one moment in the sun, and here I gotta share it with you guys.
Well, it's that sucks, but it's a beautiful song, and it's something that it stayed with me. We use the song in my TV show, Drop Dead Diva, for a sequence that when J.B. Babbitt was directing, and so she brought it in. We had a queer prom, And so they all slow dance to Save Me, which is beautiful. Yay. And so, so good. But your music has been a constant with me for as long as I was really into music. And I remember probably the first appearance was like an MTV video news segment about you singing during Voices Carry and standing up in the theater. And how terrifying that was to actually like start singing. And you know, the guy in the tank top that, "You don't care about me."
Oh God, he was such a mug. He was such a lump.
And I remember going, why would she like him? Like, I'm like, I don't think that she
because
would.
I wasn't at the casting is the problem.
I was like, what an odd choice to like him. And then I'm like, well,
I've been
with guys like that, you know, but it was kind of a funny thing of like, I couldn't see you together. And I was kind of like, I don't know. And I don't think she should. He's not ready for her anyway. But then I like you in the black wig.
Thank you.
It's so beautiful. But that song is really amazing. I mean, and the song, I think, really, it carries on.
Mm, thank you.
It's a beautiful one.
I think it's like the, 3,000th anniversary. I can't remember how long ago it was, like 85. So,
Yeah.
So it's some giant anniversary of it. And my manager and I were looking through old tapes to see if there were, you know, tapes of demos and stuff. And there was a demo version that I actually think is better than the original.
Wow.
Where the lyrics are almost totally different. I knew I had changed some of them, but I didn't realize I changed them all. And it was sung to a, instead of like him, it was sung to a her.
Ooh.
And it's so much more interesting. And of course the record company was like, oh, we can't have a woman singing to a her. Like that's, you know, that can't be done. But yeah, like I think it's actually much better. So I think we're going to release it in some fashion.
Oh, I love it. Because I think that actually it makes sense to have it be two women in the song because it's like the Voices Carry thing speaks to the fear of the secrecy of queerness in the 80s.
Yeah.
And how dangerous it was to sort of be outed. And so you had to sort of really keep it under wraps.
Yeah. I mean, mind you, that was not in my mind. It was like I got the idea for the song, a friend of mine, a guy was telling me about a girl that he was seeing, but she was trying to keep the relationship secret.
Yeah.
And so I was just singing from his point of view. Like I wasn't thinking about anything more interesting than that. But I do like it that it has this application.
Yeah. And then but much later on, if you could like have if you're singing to a woman, then like you could look at it this historic perspective of it and be like, oh, well, that's the other layer of baggage that you could put on there.
Yeah, exactly.
Which gives it real resonance. I think that so then there was I remember that. And then I remember you're in a Rush video.
Yeah.
Which is so cool.
Yeah. I got to sing. I know. And I think I was the only person who like was on a Rush song.
I think so.
That wasn't a Rush member.
I know, which is a huge big deal.
It's so sweet that they called me and asked me to do that. I don't really know why. I think probably somebody was like, you should get some new wave girl on this.
So good.
Like, who knows why that happened, but I'm so glad it did.
Are you a new wave girl? I kind of...
Oh, I was then. I mean, new wave.
I guess. Well, in Voices Carry, there is some Cars DNA. There's some Boston.
Yeah, for sure.
There's some Boston.
We loved the Cars. I mean, they were like our Boston, you know, new wave heroes.
Everything.
Yeah.
And the spare guitar, that the sort of bass line of it. It's quite you get in new wave, I guess you get the sketches of songs and they're sort of like it's not as full and resonant as like the 70s.
Yeah.
So you get like that kind of like tense plucking feeling, which I think is in
it's that. A lot of chunk, 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 chunk. Love. Yeah, a lot of that stuff.
I love. But I don't think of you as a new wave singer, even though I guess that would be technically right, I guess. But it's to me, you're much more of a Renaissance woman because there's a lot going on. You know, it's not just music, it's comedy, also film work, also, you know.
Thank you.
Lots of stuff. So the diversity is pretty profound.
Well, you know, it's like you like to say yes to stuff. I mean, and I think ever since, you know, I mean, I first met you at the old Largo, mm-hmm. the Cafe Largo in Los Angeles, and because my husband and I would go to the Monday night comedy night.
Yeah.
And so ever since those times, like, I've been really interested in comedy and really attuned to comedians, and mm-hmm. like, I just find the quickness of mine and the use of language so fascinating.
Yeah.
So, you know, anytime anybody asks me to do anything comedy adjacent, I'm like, I'll give it a try.
It's great. It's great. And it's really, I mean, I love like all of the Christmas stuff that you do with Grant, and it's really, I mean, I think it's just so inventive and so exciting. So like, I think that the main jump, I guess, for you musically, for me, was probably going solo, mm-hmm. and then your solo records, and you know, the tone change. And I think it's a time thing too. So it's like going from something like Voices Carry to 4th of July mm-hmm. is such a big shift. But I can see where it goes, like, musically. Like, did you think, like, okay, this is what I want to turn into, or this is what I'm going to be? Or was it more like your writing seemed to be more yourself? In which incarnation do you think starts? Is it?
I think when I was in Till Tuesday, we were listening to a lot of like funk dance music, like the Gap Band and Chic and stuff.
Of course.
So most of what we did when we first started out was like, you know, just a funk groove, like gung gung ba ba, like, you know, like a sort of mid tempo funk groove. And so Voices Carry, like that, just straight dunk 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 dunk. That was kind of an anomaly for us. And that was the first record. And then I used to write songs on the bass, which is mm-hmm. why so much of it was more, you know, groove oriented. And then I started writing songs on acoustic guitar. And so my writing totally changed. And I think my singing style changed because the way I was singing before, I mean, besides being like kind of new wave influenced, was, you know, just born out of shouting over bad monitors and in like crummy little clubs. So once I got into the studio and could hear myself sing, I just started to sing different, you know, differently, like more, you know, I tried to sing more like my speaking voice. Mm-hmm. So that's really like the evolution is the, you know, the tools really shaped the sound.
Yeah. And I can feel that, like, there is something also, it reminds me of Karen Carpenter because it's in the closeness of your mouth to the microphone mm-hmm. that is the perfect place to hear it. And so it's really ideal to listen to you on headphones because it's an intimacy.
And I just have a very soft voice, so I have to get right up on the mic.
But there's something about the amplification that almost brings it closer to the ear as opposed to louder,
right,
which I think is rare.
Yeah,
I don't want to be that close to a singer.
Yeah. I know most people are, I don't really want them whispering in my ear late at night in headphones.
I like it when it's Karen Carpenter. I love it when it's you. I think maybe Thank I wouldn't you. Like it if it was like Bjork.
Yeah.
Although I love Bjork.
But it might be a little scary or intimidating.
It's more like a jump scare.
Yeah.
Like, what's happening? Are there singers that you listen to either now or then that kind of maybe inspire you or that you think of?
My favorite singer is Colin Blundstone from the Zombies. I think got the greatest voice. It mm-hmm. is like a little piece of velvet on your ear. Mm. It's so great. His tuning is so great. His phrasing is great. Everything about him is great. So much like feeling and personality. Mm. I think he's the best. He's the best rock singer.
Yeah. I like this guy that I've been listening to a lot named Steve Eggers. Mm-hmm. He's in a band called The Nines, and they are very, it's like anything power pop I'm kind of like been listening to lately.
Uh-huh.
So it would be him or something like the band that there's a band called The Shivers, which is like a weird 80s. Anything that was made between 1978 and 1981,
uh-huh.
I want to listen to. Records.
Yeah.
Or like John Wick and the records, or like any Cheap Trick.
The records, I love the records.
The records are so good.
Love the records.
I love power pop because it's all about a record deal going bad, fights with your band
members. Starry eyes. I know. I love it, right?
I love it. Yeah. I love like you getting stranded in a city that you don't want to be in, liking your record label. So that's like any kind of Nick Lowe rock pile song.
Nick Lowe's the greatest.
He's so great.
Yeah.
He's so great.
He's a great songwriter.
He's a great songwriter. You know,
power pop or non-power pop song. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like all of his songs are great.
Everything. And I love to watch him. And he's kind of my Mr. Harris also.
Yes, for sure.
Like yeah. If I see him, I'm like, oh.
That is your older man template.
Yeah. You know, he never goes outside without a hat.
Yeah.
He's very Mr. Harris and but such a beautiful songwriter and uses those like... it's a seventh chord so judiciously, like it's asking a question, which I'm always like really excited about. Yeah. Like, oh, then that's power pop too, when they're like ascending chords to ask questions or the disappointment of a descending.
Right. That's so funny.
Transition. Yeah. But so then like if you're going now, so you're going to do... you're in a writing process now or thinking about it?
Yeah, I've been working, I'm into writing musicals. Like that's kind of my, for the last couple of years, there's been a couple of musicals I've been working on. And, you know, I'm not really sure what the status, I was asked to write music for a musical version of Girl Interrupted. And I'm not really sure what the status is because I'm finding out that like everything takes forever.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote a bunch of songs for it and then recorded them. So I'll put those out as a record, which is, you know, which they're fine with. So, you know, that may be staged someday and it may not.
I love that idea though. I mean, what a great,
I think it's a really great idea. I think it's, you know, certainly like I love writing about crazy people. Love it. You know?
Yeah. But the way that you write about crazy people is like, it's so like, because crazy people don't know they're crazy. So we don't know we're crazy. We're just in it, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I've had moments where I'm like, okay, this is what a crazy person does or thinks. Mm-hmm. Like where I felt like worried about my sanity.
Mm-hmm.
Like mm-hmm. I've definitely experienced that.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do too. But I also, and I've at the edges, I've been at the edges of like substance abuse and things like that and writing about that and like comedy or whatever. It's like, I feel like I'm in it. But then there's always this like thing of threat of like, I'm still sane though. Like I'm still sane because I can explain it to people who are not feeling this.
Right, right, right.
You know, so that's kind of my lifeline to sanity, I think, is that if I'm creating art about it, I can't be all that crazy.
Right.
But maybe I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a helpful tool. Like it's to describe, you know, to be aware of how you feel and describe how you feel and to share that with somebody else is how you walk yourself out of a lot of kinds of mental illness. I mean, obviously some kinds of mental illness are, you know, more a chemical intractable situation, but.
Right. But then it's that sort of like being able to present it as art to somebody else keeps you out of the Syd Barrett range.
Yeah,
I'm always like kind of like a little bit receding from the Syd Barrett. Like there's a part of me that I could go full Syd Barrett.
Yeah.
And like really lean into it. But I try to stay present and not that crazy by having a lifeline of comedy or whatever.
Yeah.
Music to get there. But yeah, a musical from you would be just perfect. I think that I love musicals.
Someday.
I love musicals, but I don't a jukebox musical.
Oh, I hate that because it's never about the story.
Right.
The songs have to forward the story. And obviously the songs are not written for the story.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, they're there. I mean, it would take a really, I don't know, even with a really skilled book writer. But I think, I feel like usually the book writers just go like, meh, it's... Hey, they're just here to hear a bunch of songs in a row. Let's stitch these together loosely. Who cares?
Yeah, it's kind of knitted together.
That drives me crazy. Yeah.
It's a lost opportunity because, like, if you looked at, like, the Queen musical, which is very, very successful, but if it was actually about Queen, that would be so much better.
Yeah.
But instead, it's about this weird futuristic place where music is outlawed.
I didn't see that one. What's your Rocket Man opinion?
Well, that's different because... it's his story. So it's like this thing of like, oh, that's great. You know, but this is not the Queen biopic, the Queen musical that was in London. We Will Rock You.
There was a musical.
They had a jukebox musical.
I didn't realize that. Wow.
Yeah. So it was, the Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie, it's a biopic, so it's great.
Uh-huh.
Because that's what I would hope the Queen musical would have been.
Right.
Which is about Freddie Mercury and all of his life. But... And Rocket Man is, it's just Elton John, which is great.
Yeah.
But the jukebox musical, We Will Rock You, is about when music is outlawed and they keep finding these opportunities to play all these Queen songs that have nothing to do with this.
I'm going to say right now that that sounds like a dumb idea.
Yeah, it's stupid. But it's written by Ben Elton, who's a great writer. So it should be great.
I should probably keep my mouth shut.
No, no, no.
It's probably somebody I'll run into.
It should be awesome. Yeah. Like, that's the thing. I love Ben Elton, and I have so many instances of his brilliance, so that if I have an instance of his not being brilliant, I'm going to bring it up.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like that.
Also, you just never know what's going to work. Like, some musicals, the concept sounds so dumb, and then they turn out to be so great.
Yeah, you never know. And you know, I think my favorite is probably, well, I love Hamilton, of course, but then there was this period where I could only listen to Hamilton, and I listened to Hamilton so much that I couldn't listen to anything else. And then I'm like, I burnt it.
You broke it.
I broke that. But I do love, like, I love Rent. Rent is a great one. Hedwig is a great one. Mm-hmm. So there's so many that I love so much. Yeah. Hair.
You like the rock musicals. The music in Hair is so great. It's there's the story is kind of all over the place, mm-hmm. but the music is so great. There's so much music, though. There's so many songs. They just keep coming.
All different styles.
I love it. I know. I love the melodies to every single one.
It's so good.
Sometimes the lyrics. There's a lot of Liszt songs in Hair.
It is mostly lists.
It's a lot of lists. I mean,
it's mostly all of the different drugs you could do, the different sexual paraphilias you could have, and the hair.
Yeah, and then like what are different initial combinations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of initial combinations.
LBJ.
Yeah.
All the things I don't have here. I don't got no. Yeah, a lot of lists. At least 7 list songs, I think.
A lot of lists. Also, the different attributes of white boys and black boys.
Yep,
mm-hmm. Which is great too. But it is. There's so many songs, and they also don't. And none of them sound like they're in the same show, except for the lists.
Yeah.
And then that's a funny one. I also love Godspell.
Love it. Yeah. Stephen Schwartz.
So great.
Yeah. Happy. Great pop melodies.
Pop melodies. Yep. But there's some of it's kind of like Harry Nilsson inspired, or maybe it's Jerry Goffin or something. There's something deep about it.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate it. But I would love to hear an Amy Mann musical.
Someday.
You'll
get the call for the reading.
It's going to be the best. Well, you're the best. Where can people find your shows and everything about you on the internet?
I do have a website, amyman.com. So that, you know, if I have tours and stuff, that won't. I don't think I have anything coming up. I think I might be doing some shows with Rufus Wainwright
in September.
We're talking about that.
That's great. That's a really good combination.
That would be so fun.
That's a really good combination.
Fantastic.
I went on tour with him one time, and I never had anything on my writer, but he always did, but he would always leave early. So I would steal all of his Nutella.
Oh my God.
So he had really, like, he had a horn section. So they always had lots of Nutella. So I would just steal it every day.
Is that, you know, horns love Nutella.
They do. Because this is circular breathing. They need that chocolate energy to keep going. And, but Rufus is so awesome.
He's amazing.
I remember when before he was a star, he would come to the old Largo, and John Bryan would have to tell everybody to shut up, because there was something about, like, the late night John Bryan show where they would just get so rowdy.
Yeah.
And then Rufus, here's this guy with a fucking pocket watch. He was like he was kind of Victorian, kind of Lord Byron, kind of steampunk.
Yeah, for sure.
And
yeah,
he had a pocket watch.
I did not realize.
And a vest.
That's so funny.
And that nobody would listen if he played. And so John would have to stand on stage and tell everybody to shut up.
That's kind of amazing, because Largo is really a place where, you know, Flanny would tell you to shut
up. Yeah, yeah.
But right out of the box.
This was way before, I think,
like late at night.
Late at night.
Just really good.
Way before Rufus was famous.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a kind of a thing of, like, what's happening? I mean, now, of course, we know that that would never happen, but back then it was just like they were starting to work on Rufus's first record.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so Rufus was kind of coming in and with the pocket watch.
Pocket watch really stood out for you.
I can't stop. It was like What's the Christopher Reeve movie? It's like with time. I don't know if it's time. It's time in a bottle. Yeah. No.
Time after time.
Time after time.
Yeah. Or, yeah.
It's like very like, it's Jane Seymour and Christopher Reeve. Mm-hmm. It's time after time.
Yeah. And he like through hypnosis goes back in time, something like that.
And there's a pocket watch. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much. I love you.
I love you too. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now my conversation with comedian, filmmaker Jenna Friedman.
I was watching your comedy and I was so laughing about the true crime situation. Like, I think it's so, you're so right about how we do, women watch true crime in order to not do what they did or just to be safe. I totally watch it for that reason or listen to it for that reason.
Yeah, it's an escapism, but it has reached this like peak where it's just, there's so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are, when I heard that there were tours going to like wherever they filmed Making a Murderer, you just grieve for the families.
Mm-hmm. It's intense.
It's intense. And then there's such an economy around it, but mm-hmm. the families who are grieving see none of that money. And like, right. it's a thing we like to not talk about, but it's just the whole thing is so, it's such a bizarre economy.
It is. But I do think that it is like, I watch and read and listen to the different podcasts in order to avoid the situations that come up. You know, I think that it is like, certainly the world is a hostile place for women.
Yeah.
So that it makes you reminded of that.
Yeah. And there I think there's an awareness among the community that it can be exploitative. So there are a lot of victims' families do appreciate people drawing attention to cases that mm-hmm. detectives or that the criminal justice system has just been unable to or not had the resources to care about.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I think there are, you know, the more we kind of talk about it, it's getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And also so many of the crimes are just like big, like from before there was Google Earth. So there's like also a kind of funny thing about like technology being helpful to women in that regard.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, but there's like also this weird, they call it hybristophilia when you fall in love with a murderer or like a violent person. And that's like a very big deal. I mean, it maybe not even a literal sense, but the fans around like Ted Bundy or somebody like that, it's really horrifying.
It's upsetting. Do you think it's gender? Do you think like more, it's more of like a female into men who are that way? Or do you think...
Well, I think it is because men are naturally, we're just, you know, they're the ones killing.
Yeah.
I mean, the female murderers, I'm sure, have the same kind of pull,
but if they usually murder their partner, then it's like it makes you less want to get involved with them.
I guess, but it's like the weirdness of that, like being sort of like a matinee idol or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very creepy thing.
A while ago, I wrote a whole screenplay about a woman falling in love with a serial killer, but it wasn't actually about murder. It was just like a metaphor for love and what you're willing to put up with when you meet someone you love.
Oh, that's great.
And also in New York, where I was living forever, it's so hard to connect and meet people
mm-hmm.
that he was like a feminist, even though he only killed men. And he also like,
oh,
yeah. That's nice. And she was like, he like supported what she did professionally.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know. I think... there's something weird, and I think it was maybe because it came out of I dated somebody who was like an alcoholic, and then like I just, all the energy and sadness I felt after we broke up, I put it into like trying to be creative. So mm-hmm. it was really just like a metaphor, like it was kind of autobiographical about dating like an alcoholic. But I do think women do put up with so much stuff that like it's funny to like look at like a guy like, you know, it wasn't even Ted Bundy. It was Gary Ridgway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there was this Netflix show called like Who the Bleep Did I Marry or something.
Yeah.
And this woman who was married to Gary was interviewed, and you could see how much he loved her and
right.
what a, like a healthy relationship that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And then you there are like the darkly comedic elements where she was like, you know, did I have any like signs? Like maybe the one time when we were moving in and getting serious, he took me to help him buy a new carpet or something. Like horrible
oh,
stuff.
Oh, God.
But it is. It's interesting to think about, like, especially, like, men like Gary Ridgway or BTK who had, mm-hmm. like, families
yeah.
and were good fathers
right.
and doing this thing. And then a lot of times doing it to, like, sex workers and vulnerable women and what we as a society almost permit or, like,
right.
how, I mean, it's the whole paradigm or whatever is really kind of, it's a fascinating, like, way to view, like, inequality and,
mm-hmm.
and racism and how messed
right.
up our society is by, like, how we see serial killers in the public imagination.
Yeah, it's true. It's a very strange, skewed vision. I mean, there was like a period in the 90s where I think like all of that was kind of like growing as a subculture, like true crime and like crime in general and gore and lurid stories like these true detective stories. And it, we were very jaded as a society, very cynical in the 90s. And it was kind of all about this sort of very like self-hatred thing, and it was like very Gen X to be like really depressed. And so I remember getting into like a lot of that kind of like literature, like serial killer like books, and a lot of people were buying like John Wayne Gacy paintings. He was still alive at, I think at that point, and so they were like buying his artwork for a lot of money. And it's so crazy to me like that was a thing that was
so
like real.
You think that we're like more, I guess, or like less jaded now? Or
I think we're less jaded. I think that there is more of an understanding that these are real stories, that it's not make-believe, that it's not like horror,
yeah.
and that there are real victims who suffer every day without their family members or are in pain because of what happened. So it's something that I think we're looking at more in a well-rounded way, like you were saying, like, you know, thinking about just like the families and what they must go through. But I mean, I do think what's good about it is that there's attention paid to cases that were like cold cases, and that there's a lot of like armchair detectives who want to go for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's positive.
That is positive.
You know,
the whole thing with the Golden State Killer, like that
it's
is
incredible.
Like, it's incredible.
It's really incredible. And, you know, that that whole case has a lot of weird overlay with comedy because, you know,
yeah.
Michelle and Michelle's book and, you know, Patton's wife, like that whole thing, and even all of my favorite murder stuff. Actually, Karen Kilgariff and I did a sketch in my comedy special in like 1996 where we played she was a prison guard and I was a woman in love with a serial killer. It was a very dark 90s sketch, but it was something that like I think at that time seemed very outre, very like it could never happen, but now it's kind of a it's kind of almost normal.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, I think about all the women that are contacting Chris Watts in prison. You know, he was the guy that murdered his wife and the two little girls and put them in the oil tank.
Oh, God.
He gets... Last year. Yeah, he gets a lot of fan mail from women. It is a kind of... Hybristophilia is real. It's a kind of, like, eroticism around the possibility of a murderer, somebody dangerous, maybe that you can tame them, maybe
yeah,
that's it.
Or fix them, or even just celebrity around them.
Yeah, that it's something that is like, I'm such a, so much of a woman that I mm-hmm. could even civilize, you know, somebody like that. Somebody
yeah.
that is just so terrible.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think like, I'm more conscious of crime because we're like traveling all the time by ourselves. And in hotel rooms and, you know, alone. And, you know, even though, like, I'm feminist and I honestly believe that we are just as strong as men. But, you know, we're not in
physically,
a lot of ways.
Physically, in some ways, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, my fears, and I don't even want to, like, say it because I don't want to invoke it, but it's just, like, the being on stage element
mm-hmm.
more than, like, when you're not on stage. I
mm-hmm.
think that... I don't know. I admire you. Both you and Janine, I think, are two people who have always been, like, really political and outspoken.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as comics, it's a dicey, it's hard to do that and to pull it off. And then as female comics, there's just this extra level of threatening because you're threatening, you're political, even if you're not talking about politics, just being a woman on stage, occupying the space. And then to be political. And so do you feel afraid at all when you do that kind of stuff? Or did you at any point?
I don't think so. I think because there is a kind of safety in the witnesses on when you're on stage is that you're surrounded by all of the other people there. And so then some of the fear is taken away because you're in a very public way. You're there. So some of that, I think, kind of goes away. I don't know. Like I get really upset when I think about somebody like Christina Grimmie, who was the voice contestant.
Yes,
who,
I think about that, and I have chills now.
Yeah, well, she was shot during a meet and greet with fans by a super fan, or something even like Mark David Chapman with John Lennon. You know, that kind of stuff where it's like a kind of an isolated moment, and they weren't even isolated. It was like, you know, for John Lennon was on the street in front of the Dakota, and for her it was during this meet and greet. So it's like, even though you're being witnessed, you're not necessarily safe.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. But yeah, I think it's really something when you're outspoken and political and a woman, it's certainly we're at risk, you know, just talking about anything. Because we have to deal with sort of this unspoken misogyny but is so palpable and real.
Yeah, and it's my favorite people in the world are you know, female and gender fluid or gender neutral comics. Just not, I like male comics too, but I love female comics. And I think in Edinburgh this past year, mm-hmm. It's such an international scene, and a friend of mine, Aditi Mittal, she's a comic from India, and she's so funny. And also, I hate to say, like, so brave, because it's such a cliche, but what she's doing in a country where there's so much misogyny, it's so powerful and it's so important. And I just think it's, you know, we're in this weird moment where we do have fascism kind of like making a comeback all over the world, but then just outspoken women on stage being funny. I feel like, I don't know if that's enough to be like an antidote to that, but it is like such an encouraging, positive sign of democratic action.
It feels good. It feels really good. What shows did you do in Edinburgh?
I have an hour show. It's called Miscarriage of Justice. It's like I did an hour show about 4 years ago called American Cunt. I can say cunt.
Of course,
right?
Yes.
It was just like a political hour leading up to the 2016 election that we filmed for CISO. May it rest in peace. And then I just did that again leading up to 2020. I'm doing it tonight. But it's like a political hour of comedy. That it's just kind of my way to, in this weird moment, digest all the stuff that's going on.
Yeah, it's great. That's great. I love the word cunt. I love.
It's a great word.
I love it.
And it's so interesting because the title came out of a joke of my friend being like, well, there are 3,000 shows. You really need one to pop. You need a title that really gets people's attention. And it was a play on, you know, how in the UK cunt is a term of endearment.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
But then the show, and it, like, my comedy's not totally blue, but the show became really about, I mean, in the beginning, my first workshop was like 2015. So it was like right when they were announcing Trump. And I remember saying his name and people would laugh because it was just like funny that he was running.
Yeah.
And then the show became about gender, and like that election was so gendered in such a really interesting way. And the word like cunt is so funny because it's so offensive to people, but it's so much, in my mind, so much more innocuous than the word crazy, which I feel like
the
is
worst.
So bad. And
it's so bad.
It's worse than bitch because like cunt is so harsh that if somebody calls you a cunt, it reflects poorly on them.
Right.
Whereas
right.
crazy is like an erasure. So like you call someone crazy and then people stop believing that person, and it's
completely.
The worst.
Yeah, it's the worst. And it's something that's always put on women, that it's like, we're the ones that are crazy. We're the ones that are hysterical. And we're imagining all of this stuff, which is like, it's totally discounts your opinion. It just devalues everything. So you're right. That's the worst.
And I do think we're in a cool moment. I think part of it is podcasts. Part of it is like the feminist blogosphere. And just the fact that we can talk about all these things, like even just having terms like gaslighting, love bombing, you know, all these kinds of terms help us understand things that we thought we were crazy for,
right.
you know, and now it's just so refreshing. I mean, we might be in like the last breath of democratic society, but it's cool that we're talking about all these things and feeling less crazy.
Right. And it's important to like really think about like, yeah, gaslighting, love bombing. Those things are so real and happen all the time, even without people really realizing what it is or really knowing. And to have at least a way to talk about it, you know, it's helpful. But it's always very strange to be like a woman in comedy. It still is, even though we have progressed somewhat, sort of, as a society and as an industry, you know. But I think women in comedy we're just tougher, you know. We just have to deal with so much more shit and we have to support each other. And there's so few of us.
Yeah, I remember. So it's so funny, like Meryl Marco, who is just genius.
She's great.
I remember watching something from like 1980. Five or something, where some guy was asking Meryl, like, you know, what's it like to be a woman in comedy? And she almost, it was so, I've talked to her about this, but she kind of like laughed it off, because it's like we get that question so much, or questions around that so much.
Yeah.
But to see her getting questions in the mid 80s that like we were still getting in like 2005, you think that things change in a positive direction, but they don't automatically do. We really have to fight for them and keep fighting all the mm-hmm. time. And you do that mm-hmm. so well. I really admire that. I started comedy, I think, in 2005. Mm-hmm. And from then to now, it has changed in a positive direction.
Yeah.
So much. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting because we do have to make it. We can't just sit back. We can never relax, is my point.
No, and you have to continually go up against it and talk about it and talk about everything and really believe in what you're saying. It's so weird how they can sort of sense any kind of weakness or like uncertainty. It's a weird thing. And it's like, I don't know, I'm proud that we get to do comedy. I'm proud that we have this ability, but this generation it's tough.
What it feels tougher now?
I think because it's like the way that misogyny exists in comedy, it's hard to explain, but it's like invisibility is very hard to explain to men or to make real to men, because they seem to think that opportunities are there for women that are not. We have to fight through and cut through so much to even get a place at the table.
Yeah.
So I think that's most of it, is that sort of like thing of like, we're not getting the opportunities the guys get, yet for some reason they think that we do. They think
especially
that we do.
Now there is this thing where, you know, as like, I love that New York just put out a diversity tax credit. So like if you bring on more diverse casting crew, you actually get tax credits, which I think is genius, because there is this illusion. It's like when other people achieve equality to people who are in power, it feels like oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is, I think, this illusion among men to some degree that, you know, there are less jobs for them. And in some way, there are more diversified rooms. So talented people who would be excluded from that process are getting into the rooms. But the numbers in like directing and like female showrunners and stuff are still pretty bad. Like mm-hmm. almost some have gone backwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a really interesting time though, because it is all coming up and to the surface in interesting ways.
Like when I think about in not just comedy, but like indie filmmaking in the 90s, it was like an era where somebody like Harvey Weinstein could flourish because he had so much power. And there was this idea that we were in an advanced society that didn't have the casting couch, that didn't have that. But we totally were in the middle of it.
I mean, that was up until like 2 years ago. Because it's easy for me to get into this like doom and gloom thing because of like climate change, because of Trump, because of all the stuff. But Harvey Weinstein is like now maybe about to be in prison, hopefully, maybe not, but at least he's not making movies. And and that just happened this past year.
Yeah.
So there are like tangible markers of progress that we have to kind of, I think, hold on to feel less deflated.
Yeah.
And I do remember the night before the election, I went to see Full Frontal. Mm-hmm. I went to Sam's show, and then I saw, I think maybe the night before that or whatever, or after that. The night before that I saw Tig at Carnegie Hall with Aparna opening for her.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And I was so excited because since 2005, I've seen more women. I've seen more just diverse voices, non-binary folks, people of color, just getting into the mainstream and not only making stuff, getting paid to make stuff, which is always an important thing.
So great.
And then that thing happened with Trump, and it was so deflating.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because I feel like that, and we don't need to discuss that whole thing. I mean, he did not win the popular vote, which is really what I hold on to. He didn't win democratically, and there were a lot of forces at play. But I still, I think, like, if we didn't have, like, Kremlin interference and yada, yada, and yada, yada, and yada, yada, we still, like, I look at the comedy community as, like, a marker of, like, how, like, change can progress over time.
Absolutely. It's true. It's true. And it's definitely inspiring. Or that the biggest comedian can be toppled because of women. You know? I mean, think about how much people love Louis C.K. They love Louis C.K. And then, you know, women
still touring.
I know. That's the thing.
But it's good. But, like, look, Louis was always kind to me. I mean, like, coming up, he hit on every female comic I know. But he was always he wasn't – the funny thing is there were men who came out to criticize Louis who were way worse to me. And so it's, like, that's the other thing of, like, the feminist guys. And with Louis, you know, I think – he is still touring, so it's not, he's not canceled, which is also a really funny thing about how, like Les Moonves, who I think was far more dangerous than Louis, I think he has, like, a production deal, and that guy assaulted his doctor and canceled Designing Women, which isn't the same. But also, and then, like, contributed, he greenlit so many, like, Two and a Half Men and all these misogynistic shows that really influenced the culture. Like, you had men like Les and Harvey who were determining the culture, and they couldn't even be alone in a room with a woman without attacking them.
Yeah.
And that's what our society is.
Yes.
And it's really scary. But yeah, to your point with Louis, I remember having a conversation with Louis at the Cellar where he was like, I feel bad for women. You guys will drop everything if you meet someone you love. And I just remember, like, having all the feelings that we're talking about now, but I didn't know how to articulate them. Uh-huh. And then, like, when a year later when the Cosby stuff came out, before the Louis stuff came out, I wrote a joke on our conversation, and I didn't name him, but I was like, yeah, women, we might drop our careers, you know, for love because we don't have paid leave, you know, like, for a family.
Yeah.
But, like, men aren't that different. You might not drop your careers for love, but you'll fuck it up for a sex crime. And it was such a cool way to, like, articulate the frustration that I felt that I wasn't able to articulate in that, like, kind of brief Cellar conversation him. But it is a really interesting thing with him because he is such a hero. And I actually think that part of the reason that whatever happened was less actually because he assaulted the women in the room and more just because he lied about it and gaslit his fans and was seen as this truth teller and then acted differently than the way we perceived him, and we heralded him as this feminist when there are people like you and there are people like Tig and Janine who are incredible feminist trailblazers who should be making exactly what he's making and having the exact same power that he has in the industry. But we, like, look to men for all this stuff automatically.
I know. And that's what I mean. It's like the invisibility of female power is so hard to even contemplate, like, because we're just so blind to any of that. Like, we just don't see. So I think it's, I think it's really important to, like, always kind of call attention to it, talk about it, and talk about feminism.
Yeah, and when he said that he, like, lost $35 million in a day or something.
Yeah.
You're just like, is Sarah getting $35 million? Or, like, is, like, Maria Bamford getting 35? Like, what?
Yeah.
How are you guys getting these, like, I mean, it's not a question. I don't know why I'm at, it's not a question. We know, but.
Yeah.
Just, like, yeah, I think we do need to, you know, take this moment to turn our attention to people actually
doing it, talking about it, like you, me, and us. And where can people find your all of your stuff on, like, when if they want to come see you do shows, where can they?
So I do, like, tweet shows. I have this show on Adult Swim. It's not stand-up, it's live action, but it's called Soft Focus, and we're doing another episode. It hasn't been announced, but it's like my dream project. Mm-hmm. And it is feminist, but it's also like the Adult Swim demographic is a lot of like 18-year-old boys, so it's kind of, it's very silly, but we talk mm-hmm. about like campus rape, and we did a segment on harassment and gaming. Mm-hmm. So we're doing another one of those. If you're interested, you can just, a lot of them are on YouTube. You could just Google Soft Focus in my name. And then I've been doing stand-up. I'm going back to London to do some shows and
That's
stuff.
That's great.
And, yeah.
Well, I'm so glad you came today. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And nice to meet your Lucia. Cute little dog, Lucia.
Thank you.
Never miss an episode of The Margaret Show. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Margaret Show is an Erios production, with editing by Kat Hong and original music by Garrison Starr.
Powered by Acast.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.